House Democrats today picked Nancy Pelosi to stand as their candidate for Speaker when the 117th Congress convenes. If she wins that floor vote in January, it'll be her fourth term as Speaker. But the 80-year-old California Democrat also appeared to signal today that it could be her final term. More on that story in a minute. This is Washington Today for Wednesday, November 18th. I'm John McArdle. First, some other headlines from around the nation's capital. U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar said today that coronavirus vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna could be ready for U.S. authorization and distribution within weeks, setting the stage for inoculations to begin as soon as next month. And President-elect Joe Biden is moving forward with transition plans even after President Donald Trump continued to refuse to concede the 2020 election. And from the Empire State, late this afternoon, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio ordered a shutdown of all in-person instruction in the nation's largest school system, citing the region's spread of coronavirus infections. But we begin on the House side of the Capitol and today's Democratic leadership elections. Democrats met virtually to select their top leaders for the 117th Congress, where the party is expected to maintain control with a narrow majority. Pelosi ran unopposed for the speaker position. Today's vote took place by secret ballot, thanks to a secure app that the Democrats used. And while Pelosi won the support of her caucus today, the full House of Representatives elects the speaker when it convenes on January 3rd. The winning candidate for speaker requires an outright majority of the entire House, or 218 votes out of 435. Here's Speaker Pelosi earlier today after she was chosen as the Democrats' candidate for speaker.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman, for your kind words. I always accept any compliments on behalf of the House Democratic Caucus because they enable any of what we do to be possible by their courage, their integrity, and their just beautiful vision for a better America. I want to congratulate you, Mr. Chairman, on your election, re-election as chair. I want to congratulate Steny Hoyer on his re-election and Mr. Clyburn as House Democratic Leader, House Democratic Whip, Mr. Clyburn, and a new member of the leadership, the newest member of the, she's been a member of the leadership as Vice Chair of the Caucus. Now she is Assistant Speaker Catherine Clark of Massachusetts. It was a beautifully contested race, a good, I think members were pleased. And that's what I want to talk about. I wish that you could have seen the nominations and the acceptance speeches, because then you could have seen the common thread, the unity of our caucus, the values and vision, the knowledge of our subjects, the strategic thinking. You hear me talk about that all the time. But all of it connected to the hopes and aspirations of America's working families. That is what unifies us. So I'm very honored. I was kind of emotional earlier because of some of the things that were said in nomination, but also listening to the other nominations as well, as to not only the vision, but the depth of commitment, the values of our caucus. So I'm thrilled, I'm excited, and I can't wait to be elected, working with a new president of the United States, Joe Biden.
Speaker Pelosi earlier today. 15 Democrats voted against Pelosi's speakership at the outset of the 116th Congress. With some votes still being tallied in this month's elections, 10 incumbent House Democrats have been defeated, dashing Democrats' expectations of adding seats. 11 races still haven't been called, and Democrats' current 15-seat majority could shrink even further. House Republicans are running their leader, Kevin McCarthy, as their choice for speaker. Here's Minority Whip Steve Scalise of Louisiana yesterday after Republicans held their own leadership elections.
It's been a battle the last 2 years to fight for the hardworking families of this country that felt left behind by Washington for so long. And we've delivered a lot of wins for them. But there are still big issues left unresolved. I'd like to see us in these next few months get another relief package, in these next few days, really, get another relief package for those hardworking businesses that are literally hanging on by a vine, those small businesses that we've been trying to help get another round of PPP forgivable loans so we can save millions more jobs. And Speaker Pelosi, for whatever reason, has chosen not to bring a bill to the floor that has wide bipartisan support. Hopefully she reconsiders and does that. But really, over the next 2 years, we know what this fight for the future direction of our country is going to be about. It's truly a battle between freedom and socialism. And you saw voters across the country in all kind of districts reject the socialist agenda that Speaker Pelosi pushed for these last 2 years. She's going to have a tough decision to make. Does she continue catering to the most radical far-left elements of her conference, or does she work with Republicans to get things done for hardworking families? It's going to be a choice she'll have to make as Speaker, but we're not going to stop fighting for those hardworking families that make America work, that still are counting on us to work together for them. So we're going to continue battling for those hardworking families and fighting for those free market ideas that have always made America the greatest country in the history of the world.
For more on today's House Democratic leadership elections, we turn now to Scott Wong, senior reporter at The Hill newspaper. And Scott Wong, coming off of what was, by all accounts, an underwhelming performance in the 2020 elections, where the Democratic House majority shrank, Nancy Pelosi ended up having an easier time securing the support of her caucus for another term as Speaker than she did 2 years ago, after her party saw big gains in the 2018 election. Explain why.
Yeah, you know, politics is a peculiar thing sometimes. And 2 years ago, the House Democrats gained 40 net seats, which was an enormous blue tsunami, and recaptured the House majority. And in that year, Nancy Pelosi faced some difficult challenges in getting back to the speakership. And this year, it was sort of the opposite. The House Democrats and Nancy Pelosi surprisingly lost nearly a dozen seats. They saw some of their frontline, most vulnerable members go down to defeat. It was a surprise because they had been projecting that they were going to pick up anywhere between 5 and 20 seats. So this was a bad election for House Democrats. And yet, even with those dismal results, Nancy Pelosi faced no challenger for Speaker, nor did any of her top lieutenants. They basically kept their entire leadership team in place. Steny Hoyer, the majority leader, won re-election, ran unopposed. The majority whip, James Clyburn, ran unopposed, as did Hakeem Jeffries, the caucus chairman. And so the leadership team for the 117th Congress looks a lot like the leadership team we've seen in the past Congress.
Nancy Pelosi gaining the support of her caucus on a voice vote today. What happened to those reports we had heard about 2 weeks ago of some House moderates trying to recruit a challenger to the Speaker?
Well, you know, that effort never materialized. There are just a handful of some of the more moderate members who have gone on the record. Alyssa Slotkin of Michigan and Jared Golden, who have said that they will vote against Nancy Pelosi on the floor. But, you know, so far, a lot of the grumbling that had been happening behind the scenes, people talking to me on background anonymously about wanting to see Nancy Pelosi gone, and perhaps Hakeem Jeffries, the number five Democrat from New York, rising to the speakership in her place, those talks and those grumblings never really materialized into anything. Hakeem Jeffries said he didn't want to challenge Nancy Pelosi. He is a loyal lieutenant of her, and he praised her re-election or her renomination today. And what takes place now is in early January, they head to a floor vote. We've seen this play out many times before at the start of the Congress, where members will rise on the House floor and state who they are supporting for Speaker on the record. Today's vote was a closed-door secret ballot vote. And, you know, in many of these uncontested races, it was anticlimactic because they simply did it by voice vote. And so there was no recorded vote. We don't quite know how many people will not support Nancy Pelosi on the floor come January.
And to stay on that for a second, that's a tougher vote for her, because today it was the majority of her caucus that supported her. The floor vote comes down to a majority of the entire members of the House. So how many defections could she sustain in that vote that'll take place as one of the first actions of the 117th Congress?
Yeah, we don't quite know that magic number yet. She needs at least 218 votes, which is a majority of all members of the House of Representatives in order to be elected Speaker. Republicans, of course, will be supporting Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader, and so Nancy Pelosi really will need to hold her troops in line in order to win that Speaker's gavel on the floor. The reason we don't quite know how many defections she can afford at the moment is because there are still a handful of uncalled races. But because this is going to be the slimmest majority that we've seen in any House of Representatives since World War II, she will need to hold those defections down to a very small number. I think there were 15 who actually defected from her 2 years ago on the House floor. You know, people vote for other lawmakers. I remember a couple years ago, somebody voted for John Lewis, the civil rights icon who passed away this past year. And so, you know, it's always a dramatic vote. We think that because there have been no challengers who have come forward for these internal leadership battles, we think that she should have no problem. But again, you know, anything can happen in these floor votes. And of course, there are always lawmakers who are trying to cause mayhem.
And then assuming that she does hold down those defections, if she becomes Speaker in the 117th Congress, has she said anything, made any promises about when she would step down as Speaker?
Well, in fact, after her renomination today, she stepped before the podium and before reporters and said today that this, in fact, would be her last 2 years as Speaker of the House. This was a promise she had made a couple years ago where she said she would serve no more than two terms as Speaker. There was an effort to try to codify that into the House Democratic rules, imposing term limits on some of the leadership and the chairman. But that also never materialized. There was never a formal vote taken on those rule changes. But Pelosi said today, in fact, that she would honor those wishes of some of her caucus members, and she would, this for all intents and purposes, will be her last 2 years as Speaker of the House.
And I guess finally, what leadership positions have yet to be decided? What more are you watching for?
Well, the one contested race today was between Catherine Clark of Massachusetts and David Cicilline of Rhode Island. This was for the assistant speaker position held by Ben Ray Lujan, who is moving on to the Senate. And Clark won a decisive victory over Cicilline. She's somebody that we should all be keeping an eye on. She has had a steady and quick rise in the House leadership. She's a prolific fundraiser and somebody who's doing a lot of work behind the scenes. Just somebody that we should all watch as somebody who is going to be probably stepping into some of the top leadership roles once the old guard sort of steps aside. There's also another race that we should keep an eye on for tomorrow. That is between Pete Aguilar of California and Robin Kelly of Illinois. They are running for the vice chair position, and that election will take place tomorrow. That's really all the elections this week. And then after Thanksgiving, of course, we have the race for DCCC, the campaign chairman's race. And that race will be between Tony Cardenas of California and Sean Patrick Maloney of New York. So just a handful of sort of lower tier leadership races that we should all be watching for.
Scott Wong covering it all for The Hill newspaper. You can see his work at thehill.com. Always appreciate your time.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to Washington Today. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio this afternoon ordered the shutdown of all in-person instructions in the nation's largest school system, citing the spread of coronavirus infections in the region. City residents have tested positive at a rate of 3% over the past 7 days, according to the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene data, surpassing a standard set for schools staying open. Here's the New York City mayor late this afternoon.
As of today, on our seven-day rolling average for coronavirus positivity, New York City has hit exactly 3.0%. And as a result, we do need to close our schools for the coming days. No one is happy about this decision. We all, in fact, are feeling very sad about this decision because so much good work has been put into keeping the schools opening them up to begin with. Let's start there. Opening the schools when almost no other major school system in America opened, making them so safe. But we set a very clear standard, and we need to stick to that standard. And I want to emphasize to parents, to educators, to staff, to kids, that we intend to come back and come back as quickly as possible. We are working right now with the state of New York, and that was a lot of what we talked about this morning. I had a number of conversations with the governor, and our teams have been talking throughout the morning on exactly what it would take to come back and bring our schools back quickly, and it will be a higher standard. I want that to be clear. We have a stringent health and safety standard right now. We're going to have to raise that up even higher.
New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. According to the New York Times, New York City's positivity rate was at 2.06% back on November 3rd, but it's been on a steady rise ever since. The New York City Department of Education serves about 1.1 million students, making it the nation's largest school system. The next largest, the Los Angeles Unified School District, with more than 650,000 students. Earlier Wednesday morning, the final results of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine trial indicate that it has a 95% success rate, higher than an earlier analysis. The company also noted that 2 months of follow-up data also show no serious side effects. Moderna, on Monday, released preliminary data for its vaccine showing a 94.5% effectiveness. Pfizer said it expects to make up to 50 million vaccine doses this year, enough to inoculate 25 million people, and up to 1.3 billion doses in 2021. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases, provided the latest update on the coronavirus pandemic during a University of Virginia School of Medicine virtual event. During that event, he addressed the recent surge in coronavirus cases in the U.S. and Europe, as well as the COVID-19 vaccines recently announced. Here's Dr. Fauci answering questions about vaccines from UVA professor Marcia Day Childress.
Now, the question of how do you get people to be convinced to get vaccinated would depend really on what the reason that they don't want to get vaccinated. If it's lack of access to the vaccine, you're going to want to give them better access. If it's skepticism about the process, like was this rushed? And often we hear, and I never liked the terminology that was used, Operation Warp Speed, was something that was, you know, the designated process that we have now, which has actually been quite successful as testis est, the vaccines that have now shown high degree of efficacy. But the speed is really because of the extraordinary technology, the success of a novel platform like mRNA, the enormous investment in resources to the tune of billions of dollars by the federal government to pre-purchase doses so that when the trial showed efficacy, you had the doses essentially ready there for you. That is the reason why it goes so quickly. But to impress upon the public the process as an independent decision, independent evaluation of the data by the Data and Safety Monitoring Board, the career scientists at the FDA, the scientists like myself that will look at the data, the VRBPAC or the Vaccine and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee that the FDA listens to very carefully before they grant an emergency use authorization or an EUA, as well as then moving on to a BLA or biological license application. All of that is independent and transparent. And yet, because of a lot of the noise that comes out of Washington in this divisive time that we're living in, some people may say, well, I don't really trust that they're trying to rush this out to look good. Not at all. And I can tell you as a colleague of all of us here on this group, this has been an independent decision. And it has been done in the classic way that decisions are made about vaccine safety and efficacy.
Dr. Anthony Fauci earlier today. Back in D.C., U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar said today that COVID-19 vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna could be ready for U.S. authorization and distribution within weeks, setting the stage for inoculation to begin as soon as next month. States and territories are prepared to begin distributing the vaccines within 24 hours of receiving regulatory authorization, according to HHS officials on that call with reporters today, adding that complex cold storage requirements will not impede Americans' ability to access those vaccines. Here's Secretary Azar from today.
Thank you. This is Stephanie Ebb from ABC News. Can you walk us through a bit more, in a bit more detail, what might happen in that 24 hours between an EUA and shipment? And specifically, do you anticipate that the ACIP committee would meet and determine recommendations for how to prioritize that initial shipment of doses before it goes out to states or after?
Yeah, so Stephanie, that's an excellent question. And I'm working directly with CDC Director Robert Redfield on how we could convene the ACIP, hopefully concurrent with the FDA review. Customarily, they wait until there's a licensure from the FDA, and then 48 hours later, we'll meet and provide advice out. But we're working to see if we can actually facilitate a concurrent review process that's collaborative with the FDA, sharing the whatever information the ACIP would need to do its job so that it doesn't add any extra delay. With over 1,000 people perishing per day, our mission at Operation Warp Speed is about saving lives. Every hour, every day matters, and so we're going to work to try to minimize that, any type of delay there.
HHS Secretary Alex Azar. It was yesterday that Republican Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, who's 87, tweeted that he had a possible exposure to coronavirus. Today, he tweeted that he had tested positive for coronavirus. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, took time today during his floor remarks to wish the Iowa senator well.
This show of diligence and dedication is remarkable by any measure, but because of who Senator Grassley is, it hasn't seemed remarkable at all. That incredible commitment to serving Iowans and working around the clock is just who our colleague is. That devotion is just his daily routine. This is the senator who manages to visit all 99 counties in Iowa every single year. We call it the full Grassley. Nearly 9,000 consecutive Senate votes must have seemed like a cakewalk by comparison. But yesterday, our colleague's streak had to be temporarily placed on hold. On the advice of doctors, after close contact with someone who had later tested positive for the coronavirus, Senator Grassley began self-quarantining yesterday morning. Later in the day, our colleague let us know he had tested positive himself, underscoring why his good judgment to follow doctors' orders while awaiting his test result was the right decision. So our colleague's historic run has been put on pause for the same reason that it was compiled in the first place: leadership, service to others, and a determination to set the right example.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell earlier today. Senator Grassley said in a tweet this afternoon, quote, "I remain symptom-free and in isolation. I continue to feel good. Thanks for all the messages and encouragement and prayers," end quote. On the House side today, Speaker Pelosi took to the dais of the House chamber to remind her colleagues about the rules in the House when it comes to COVID-19 precautions. Here's Speaker Pelosi.
The chair will now take this opportunity to make an announcement concerning floor practice during the coronavirus epidemic. First, the chair wishes to underscore the importance of safe practices during votes. As the chair stated on July 29, 2020, under Clause 2 of Rule 1, the chair is required to preserve order and decorum in the chamber. This includes the responsibility to ensure the protection of member and staff health and safety during proceedings. To that end, Based upon health and safety guidance from the attending physician and the sergeant at arms, the chair would advise that all members should leave the chamber promptly after casting their votes. Furthermore, members should avoid congregating in the rooms leading to the chamber, including the speaker's lobby. As a reminder, the chair will continue the recent practice of providing small groups of members with a minimum of 5 minutes within which to cast their votes. Members are encouraged to vote with their previously assigned group. After voting, the members must clear the chamber to allow the next group a safe and sufficient opportunity to vote. It is essential for the health and safety of members, staff, and the U.S. Capitol Police to consistently practice social distancing and to ensure that a safe capacity be maintained in the chamber at all times. The Sergeant-at-Arms is directed to enforce this policy. Second, the chair wishes to remind members that the announcement of July 29, 2020, regarding the wearing of masks in the hall of the House remains in effect. Members and staff will not be permitted to enter the hall of the House without wearing a mask. Masks will be available at the entry point for any member who forgets to bring one. To reiterate, the chair views the failure to wear a mask as a serious breach of decorum. I repeat, members and staff will not be permitted to enter the hall of the House without wearing a mask. The chair appreciates the attention of all members and staff to these principles.
Speaker Nancy Pelosi earlier today on Capitol Hill. You're listening to Washington Today. Welcome back to Washington Today. I'm John McCardle. President-elect Joe Biden is moving forward with transition plans, even while President Donald Trump continues to refuse to concede the 2020 election. During an at-times emotional virtual roundtable with workers on the front lines of the COVID-19 crisis on Wednesday afternoon, President-elect Biden said that the General Services Administration has still not ascertained that he won the election. He warned that the delay will hamper his administration when it comes to vaccine distribution and in other efforts to combat the spread of the virus. Here's the president-elect.
I am optimistic, but we should be further along. One of the problems that we're having now is the failure of the administration to recognize the law says that the General Services Administration has a person who recognizes who the winner is, and then they have to have access to all the data and information that the government possesses to be prepared. And it doesn't require there to be an absolute winner. It says the apparent winner, the apparent winner. And we've been unable to get access to the kinds of things we need to know about the depth of the stockpiles. We know there's not much at all. We get to the point where we have a sense of when these vaccines comes out, how they'll be distributed, who'll be first in line, what the plan is. There are over 300 million Americans and beyond our border that are going to have to be taken care of. And there's a whole lot of things that are we just don't have available to us, which unless it's made available soon, we're going to be behind by weeks or months being able to put together the whole initiative relating to the biggest promise we have with two drug companies coming along and finding 95% effectiveness efficiency in the vaccines, which is enormous promise. So I just want to tell you that's the only slowdown right now that we have.
For a look now at the likely cabinet confirmation battles to come for a Joe Biden administration, we turn to Alex Thompson of Politico. And Alex Thompson, while we don't know exactly who those cabinet nominees will be, we do know more about how the Biden team is preparing for those fights ahead. So explain first what a Sherpa is when we're talking about Senate confirmations.
Well, these are the people that guide a lot of these potential nominees who, in many cases, a lot of these people are a little bit more wonky. They've certainly, a lot of them have never been on the national stage, under the national glare. that is going to hit them the second they are nominated. Not only are you going to have lots of media outlets looking into them, but you're going to have the opposition. You're going to have well-funded, GOP groups and Senate Republicans looking into every part of their history, trying to find something that, may be politically damaging as a way of, eventually hurting Vice President or President-elect Biden. And so what these Sherpas are, there's a few components to them. One is, you need someone that's going to do legislative strategy. So they hired, Dick Durbin's floor director to sort of coordinate, let's do the vote counting. We need at least 50 votes in order to get our nominee over the finish line. Then you're going to have a comms team, and that's going to be led a little bit by former White House communications director Jen Psaki, along with a former Biden Senate aide and Democratic consultant. And then you also have an outreach component, which is, this is about not only reaching out to senators, but also reaching out to outside groups and advisors to sort of line up support, line up, sort of a political campaign. I mean, the thing about these Sherpas is they, in some ways, they are running a campaign. But in this case, the campaign isn't for voters in Wisconsin, but for the 50 votes in the Senate.
You mentioned Jen Psaki. Is she a longtime Biden confidant or somebody who's come more recently to the Biden campaign?
She's definitely come more recently to the Biden campaign. She sat out this election cycle and stayed in D.C. And, told me in a longer interview over the summer about Joe Biden and Barack Obama's relationship that, that a lot of people doubted, including herself, doubted that Joe Biden was going to end up winning the nomination, let alone the White House. So, she's a little bit more of a recent addition. That being said, her relationship with the vice president goes back a long way because of her time in the White House. She was there during a lot of big pivotal moments for the Obama administration. So her relationship goes back very far, but she only very recently joined the transition team. And she also has told anyone who will ask and anyone who will listen that there's no way she is ever going to go work back in the White House this time. So maybe it happened in the future, but that's sort of her role right now, is she's taking the lead on getting Joe Biden the cabinet he wants.
You write in your story that Jen Psaki and the rest of this team that's going to be working under her could be looking to shake up some of the conventions of the confirmation process. How?
That's right. Well, so the old rules were always that the nominee should be seen but not heard, and that potential cabinet, once someone's nominated, they should just remain completely quiet until their hearing. But what they've indicated is that they're planning to do a real rollout of what they described as introducing these nominees to the American people as a way of sort of drumming up some political support and hopefully, and to their minds, hopefully putting some public pressure on these senators and not just relying on the fact that the Senate will, give the Joe Biden the cabinet he wants.
And on that point, you write that they're preparing for a fight here, but the Biden team, or at least the former vice president, is hoping for some cooperation. How realistic is that?
I mean, this is one of the big questions of the entire future Biden presidency. Is Joe Biden promised to, heal the country, bring it together, and to, restore sort of an ability of Congress to work together, to sort of restore the Senate that he grew up in, during his, several decades in the Senate. And whether or not, most times cabinets, while there's some big fights over cabinet appointees, this is an early test of whether or not Joe Biden can sort of accomplish what his ambitions are in terms of restoring that sense of, collegiality within the Senate that obviously over the last decade has been a very, contentious, polarized place. And that's why these cabinet battles, I think Joe Biden's team feels they're so important and why they've assembled such a pretty large, very experienced team.
The story is in Politico.com. The headline, Biden Builds Team for Senate Confirmation Battles. The author is Alex Thompson. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to Washington Today. On Capitol Hill, Senator Lindsey Graham today told reporters that the White House should begin intelligence briefings for President-elect Joe Biden. Here's Senator Graham from today.
Well, all I can, you know, the president is contesting the election, and I would urge him to give intel briefings to Joe Biden. How much further to go, I don't know. We're going to be fine. At the end of the day, this thing will work itself out. It always has, and it will here. What I would like to focus on now is a relief package. I think we need more than $500 billion. I think we need more PPP. We need money for schools. So at the end of the day, I understand not just throwing a bunch of money at blue states, but in South Carolina, our economy is hanging pretty tenuous because the virus has taken a toll. And I hope we can get Mitch and Nancy to go ahead and do a deal that helps us on the PP front. And that's what I want to do.
How much higher are you willing to go? Would you support like $2 trillion in that range?
It's the components, the PPP thing, are most important to me right now. On the business side, schools need money. It doesn't have to be $2 trillion, but it's got to be meaningful. Okay?
What about Operation Warp Speed? Are you concerned that Biden isn't up to speed on that?
No, I think the vaccine is 95% success rate. There'll be a way to distribute it. I'm okay with the way things are going. The president's challenging the election results and within the rule of law, and that's allowed in America.
That was Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina. Former White House National Security Advisor John Bolton said Wednesday that he fears that President Trump, quote, likely has an enemies list, end quote, with more people to fire in the wake of his loss to President-elect Joe Biden. It was during an interview with The Washington Post that Bolton sounded off on the recent string of firings in the aftermath of the election, including the dismissal of former Defense Secretary Mark Esper. And it was just last night that President Trump fired top cybersecurity official Christopher Krebs over his disagreement with Krebs' statement affirming the security of the 2020 election. Here's Washington Post national correspondent Robert Costa with the former national security advisor.
You know Chris Krebs, the recently fired director of cybersecurity and infrastructure security agency, pretty well. That firing by President Trump of Mr. Krebs was made on the heels of the termination of Mark Esper, the defense secretary. What's your reaction to the Krebs firing, and what does that tell us about where the president's going?
Well, I thought it was another bad mistake. There's absolutely no justification for it. There wasn't any justification to fire Mark Esper or the other top Defense Department officials. There wasn't any justification to fire Lisa Gordon Haggerty, the head of the National Nuclear Safety Administration, Security Administration. There wasn't any reason to fire Bonnie Glick, the deputy administrator of the Agency for International Development. There's no reason to decapitate your national security team with less than 10 weeks to go until the transition. That will inevitably cause disruptions in the agencies themselves, let alone their ability to hand off smoothly. And what I fear is, although there has been, I think, more negative Republican reaction on the Hill to Chris Krebs firing, that there's an enemies list in the White House of people still to fire. And that there's more to come.
Have you actually heard that? There is an enemies list.
No. I'm worried that there's an enemies list. There probably is in Donald Trump's head. I doubt that he's written it out.
What does it say, though, about the Krebs firing in terms of the president's intent? You say you don't believe there was a reason for the termination. But what are we as journalists, as American citizens, supposed to interpret here about the president's intent, his plan, when he fires all these officials? What's he doing?
Well, there's no legitimate reason for it. I'm sure the reason he fired Chris Krebs was that Krebs said there was no evidence in cyberspace of fraud, election hacking, or other malfeasance, which is completely contrary to the fantasy world that the president lives in, that there's a conspiracy so vast and so successful that it's proceeding without leaving any evidence behind. And, you know, under that kind of theory, you can posit evil doing forever. And what the information that the Homeland Security Department, state and local officials have put out consistently, whether, by the way, they're Democrat or Republican, is that there's no evidence of any kind of fraud or malfeasance anywhere near the scale that would change the outcome of the election.
While President Trump and his legal team continue to dispute the results of election 2020 in several key states, Yahoo News today out with a story about what life after the White House could be like for President Trump. White House correspondent Hunter Walker is one of the reporters on that story, titled Trump in Exile, How He Will Remain a Force in the GOP and a Threat to Biden's Politics of Unity. Hunter Walker, start on the former. How does a former President Trump maintain the grip that he's had on the Republican Party for the past 4 years?
Well, you know, the first element of that is it's not clear that we are going to get a former President Trump at any point, and certainly not in any traditional sense. I mean, obviously, President Trump is someone who for a long time has never followed, you know, the old school political script. But also, you have a guy who, you know, despite a little bit of muddling in that message, has refused to concede and, you know, still publicly is maintaining that the presidential race is very much on. Sources close to him told me that, you know, that's part of an effort to, quote unquote, keep his options open. You know, that could mean kind of riling up his base for either a media operation or potentially a 2024 campaign. And of course, the president and people close to him maintain that, you know, if there's some way, and it's looking increasingly improbable as his various legal challenges fail, but if there was some way where he could stay in office, he'd gladly do it. But even if he doesn't do that, he seems to, you know, have very clear plans to remain active in the political arena, in the media space, and potentially just to run again. And that is not something we've seen in the modern era where, you know, the traditional post-presidency is you set up your library, you do your memoirs, and, you know, there's that longstanding unwritten rule that you don't criticize your successors. And he seems ready to break all of that. And that will have major, major implications for the Republican Party and for Joe Biden.
So talk about what the past 2 weeks have taught us about how Republicans, how much they're likely to continue to take their cues from him. And in part, because election 2020 isn't over, there's still two very consequential runoffs happening in early January, even if we're not talking about the presidential results then.
Right. So what you're seeing on the Republican Party, I mean, you know, we should be very clear, when the president refuses to concede, when he falsely declares victory, I mean, this stuff is just baseless. All these wild allegations of fraud that he's throwing out there. Yet, in spite of this, the Republican Party has, you know, by and large, indulged what are essentially delusions of victory on the president's part. I mean, apart from, you know, that handful of, you know, traditionally swingy senators, you know, Murkowski, Collins, Romney, Sass, you know, you are seeing the GOP, you know, shy away from calling Joe Biden the president-elect, parrot some of these allegations of fraud. And there's two big reasons for that. You know, one is that the president is, as I outlined earlier, you know, likely to remain on stage in a very unusual way. And the other is that he's extremely popular within the Republican base. You know, different polls have shown that he has about 90% approval or 90% support within the GOP. And as you pointed out, we have these crucial Senate races coming up in Georgia, these two special elections, these runoffs that could, you know, decide the balance of Congress. And that's kind of the canary in the mine for what we are seeing for the Republican Party, because, you know, they need the over 2 million Georgians who just voted for Trump. They need as many of them to turn out in these runoffs as they possibly can, with his unique support, with the possibility he could kind of use his Twitter bullhorn or host some of his signature rallies. You know, they need those things. They need that engagement from him in this race. A Democratic operative who's working in the state, you know, told me quote, the Republican Party is the party of Trump. Without him, they're nothing. They 100% need him if they want any chance at surviving this special election. And you're seeing Republicans make, you know, perhaps less pointed versions, but similar comments about how crucial Trump is. And this is, you know, the first big race since his election, but, you know, it's true by and large. You know, when we see races in the future, you know, Republicans are going to need the president's base behind them. And I think the most dramatic example of that and how GOP politics have been frozen in place by the president's refusal to exit the stage, none of the likely, you know, 2024 or talked about 2024 Republican candidates have crossed him at all. I mean, one of them, you know, we all know Secretary of State Joe Pompeo has his eyes on the presidency. And he's the one who said, you know, we're going to see a transition to a quote-unquote second Trump administration. So everyone is afraid to cross him, and they're all lining up behind him.
A minute or two left here, but you mentioned the president's Twitter bullhorn. How much do you think the mainstream press will continue to hang on every tweet or every inflammatory accusation from a former President Trump? And take us through what we know about right now about that long-rumored Trump media endeavor.
Well, I think these two things go hand in hand. You know, I think you're seeing with Twitter's recent decision to, you know, put these markers on his tweets when the president is tweeting out these misinformations, these baseless claims about voting. You know, the media is kind of learning on the fly, and social media is learning on the fly how to deal with a political figure who has such a prominent office and is so willing to make false claims. So you're seeing resistance to that, but that's never really been a problem for President Trump, in part because, you know, he lives in his own echo chamber with his base. And whether it be them following him on Twitter or, you know, them watching him on conservative networks, you know, the president has always had his own ways to reach his base. And as the, you know, support numbers show, they don't care what anyone else says about him. You know, Fox is breaking from him a little bit. He's very angry with Fox about that. But OAN and Newsmax fully support him. And we're also seeing rumblings that, you know, he could potentially partner with Newsmax on his own bid. I've talked to allies of the president who definitely say he's considering a media operation that could potentially be in conjunction with the 2024 campaign. And this idea that the election was stolen, this essentially lie, will be the central foundation of any of his post-presidential endeavors.
Hunter Walker is a White House correspondent for Yahoo News. If you want to read his story, the headline, Trump in Exile, How He Will Remain a Force in the GOP and a Threat to Biden's Politics of Unity. Appreciate your time.
Thanks so much.
And we appreciate you today joining us on Washington Today. If you've missed any part of this program, remember you can listen to it wherever you listen to podcasts. We hope you enjoy the rest of your evening.
With coronavirus cases increasing across the country, use our website, cspan.org/coronavirus, to follow the trends, track the spread with interactive maps, and watch updates on demand anytime at cspan.org/coronavirus.